Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is John Chad. He's a writer and illustrator, and we're talking about his new book, Pinball, A Graphic History of the Silver Ball. Go. John, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Now, you have a long-time interest in pinball.
Mm-hmm.
When did that start?
My serious interest in pinball didn't really start until like 2009 or so. But it was always kind of on the peripheral of my gaming interest. I spent a lot of time as a kid in arcades, specifically in the mall, the Aladdin's Castle, and then later the Dream Machine arcade. And as I was playing the machines, the pinball was always looming in the background, and I would always play a couple games, and it just never quite got its claws into me. And it wasn't until 2009 that I was in a very—I was living in a very, very small town in White River Junction, Vermont, and there's not a lot to do for fun. And there was this pool hall across the street from this cartoon school that I was working at, and they had a Star Wars Episode I pinball machine.
Oh, wow!
And my friend and I, we love Star Wars so much that we were just like, we got to get into this machine. And it just blew the doors open on the entire like pinball community. We just like used that as a gateway and just got more and more and more obsessed with it.
It's really funny because I'm from a much older generation and I identify with the games from the 70s and the 80s.
Sure, sure, sure.
And that's what's usually, there was like a couple of pinballs in some like odd joint. And you really, it was like nothing else to play these games. It was really fantastic. And you mentioned in the beginning of this book that for people who have never played a pinball machine, especially people who have only done online games, people may ask what the big deal is about pinball. It seems like archaic. You have to have played a good pinball machine to really understand to get it. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I think you just need to be kind of, you need to be listening to what the machine is telling you. Because if you just look at it at first blush, you're looking at a box that's full of lights with a ball, you know, that's just rolling around. You're just trying to flip, flip, flip. And if you're not listening to like the things that the machine is trying to tell you about the rules, about the story, then that's all it's ever going to be. So, you know, I agree. A good pinball machine is one that can clearly communicate what's the theme, what's the story, what are the rules, what's exciting about it. You know, one of the old pinball executives, Herb Jones, he coined this phrase like, what was it? Like, you know, so close, try again.
That's right. That's right.
And that's the spirit that they wanted each game to give you, that you got so close that you were just one shot away.
But you never felt like you were being cheated. You never felt like you were being denied on purpose. You were really invited to try again.
What I love is the
quote from your book is, between the plunge and the drain, a cacophonous world of infinite possibilities. Oh, my God.
No two games are ever going to be the same. And you can't say that about a Mario. You can't say that about, you know, a Halo, like any sort of modern shooter. Like, you know, AI can only go so far. There is a level of predictability. There is a level of strategy that you can employ that's going to work every single time for most games. And with pinball, that's not the case. I could be playing a Medieval Madness in California and drive two states over and play another Medieval Madness, and my strategies aren't always going to work the same. The machine's going to play different based on how clean it is, based on what the incline is, and it forces you to maintain adaptability and kind of constantly evolve your own skill set to what that specific game is requiring of you.
I think the great thing is you decided to do this as a graphic history instead of a written history, because I think the graphic history really lends itself to pinball.
There's something that I've always found akin between comics and pinball.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way that, like, pinball, if you just strip away all of the kind of magic and alchemy behind it, it's a box with lights and a ball rolling up a piece of plywood. And then through graphic design and illustration and light shows, it's transformed into this piece of narrative gaming. The same way with comics. Comics are just lines on paper. But through this kind of alchemy of design and, you know, the intersection with words, suddenly you get, you know, stories that take place in fantastical locations with characters that are emitting sounds from their mouth. That's all illusion. That's all, you know, slap doodle. There's no sound
slap doodle
coming off a comic.
Whoa. Whoa. Now you that just made the show. 1930s, you declare, is the golden age of pinball. Why is the 1930s?
It's just because of the proliferation and the speed at which the advancements were coming. You know, today, if you kind of poke around the internet, you'll find that anywhere between 3 to 7 machines are kind of released from all of the manufacturers, of which there are more than there were 10 years ago. We are in a boom in pinball for sure. But compare that to the 300 machines that were coming out. I'm not talking 300, you know, machines off the line. I'm talking 300 different titles.
Right, right.
And just as you were saying, even as far back as, you know, not as far back as the 70s, pinball had a level of visibility and proliferation in American culture that we just don't see. You know, we were seeing pinball machines even in the 70s in, like, convenience stores and bodegas.
That's right.
Places that wouldn't engage in coin-operated gaming now. You're not going to find, or in very rare cases, you're not going to find, like, a stand-up arcade machine in the back of your 7-Eleven.
What was interesting was reading about the blowback in the 1930s to pinball in your book. Like, it went under vicious scrutiny and critique. And talk about that. I mean, people considered it a machine that's going to fleece children. They made a lot of associations with a pinball to a slot machine.
Well, and that's because they saw it as purely random. They saw, like, I flip the ball, I plunge it onto the playfield. And back then, pinball didn't have flippers, right? So you're just plunging the ball, and it's hitting a series of pins, where it gets its name, and then those it would fall in a hole. And people saw that trajectory as random, and they didn't quite understand that, no, you can shake the machine, you can pull the plunger back a certain amount. It's not binary like a slot machine. A slot machine, you just pull once, then there's all sorts of random mechanisms inside that determine the outcome. Pinball, you have control. And they just had a harder time seeing that. You know, and this is a parallel that I didn't quite, you know, have time and space to draw in the book, but I think that gaming has always kind of been, you know, under, in
that's
the
right
crosshair, so to
well
say.
Well, absolutely, you know, absolutely, yep.
Yeah.
What was amazing was to read about Fiorella LaGuardia, the mayor of New York City. I mean,
this was his thing. This was his thing that he thought was like, I'm going to get on the newspapers. I'm going to get famous. I'm going to get rid of this thing that I myself have created as kind of a scourge of society. And he did, you know what, to his credit, he did a very good job of it. Well, he did a good job of what he set out to do to the detriment of pinball, but to his credit.
Well, I mean, and he talked about turning the wooden legs of the pinball machine into billy clubs for police.
Oh, he loved it. He would set up these press meetings where he would have these confiscated pinball machines and he would push them over. He would have to, he had this sledgehammer called the sledgehammer of decency that he would use to smash machines.
It was like Thor's hammer, but not so much.
No. But for evil.
But for evil. People may not realize, I mean, pinball was illegal in many states.
Yeah, you know, a lot of states were kind of back in the 30s and 40s. I think that they were taking their cues from some of these places like Chicago, Los Angeles, New York. But the laws were all different on a local level. If you looked across the country, like some places, pinball was outlawed entirely. In some places, there were certain aspects of pinball that they saw that they thought were more gambly than others. And so those aspects, like maybe bumpers or extra balls, would be outlawed. Huh. It was really just a monster mash of different laws. But ultimately, it still kind of carried this connotation of it being a tool of the criminale.
Now, there's some incredible information in this book. And one of them is the story of Roger Sharp versus the Committee on Consumer Affairs. And that, I'm surprised the film hasn't been made out of that.
I think that there is a film coming of it.
Are you serious?
I think so. Yeah, I feel like I've seen the poster of it on Facebook. I would poke around. I don't have it up in front of me, but I think it might happen because it's definitely like a blockbuster story. It's
no kidding! Like, oh my God,
David and Goliath. You know, people liken it. So for your listeners, Roger Sharp is this journalist. He's a writer. He's a photographer, and he's a great pinball player. And he's in New York at the time, and there's a couple different entities that are looking to re-legalize pinball. This is in the 1970s, 76, I think. And you know, to be honest, they're not doing it purely for like altruistic, like, you know, freedom of gaming and personal freedoms reasons. They want money. You know, the New York City Council, there's people in it that want to, you know, have a fee for people to run pinball machines. And then there's the, like, the CoinOp Amusement Organization, I forget the acronym, and they want to, like, you know, make money off of pinball again. But whatever their reasons, they bring Roger Sharpe out, they put him in front of the New York Committee on Consumer Affairs, and his goal is to convince them that pinball is not a gambling device. It's not a game of chance. It's a game of skill.
Now, he's set to demonstrate. He's set to demonstrate on a machine. And the person who's directing the committee switches to another machine.
They really wanted him to fail. And so
they,
for whatever reason, when I talked to Roger, it didn't seem like there was any sort of particular reason why they switched from the El Dorado to the Bank Shot. But they had this Bank Shot machine back in the back as a backup machine in case the El Dorado machine self-destructed or whatever. And so they wheel that out thinking that maybe he had some sort of device, or he had prepared the El Dorado machine before, or like if he like practiced specifically on that machine. The bottom line is they wanted to catch him off guard. They wanted to put him off his game so that he wouldn't be able to perform under pressure. And that wasn't the case. He beautifully executed a perfect game. He was calling shots. He was explaining the game.
I can't believe it was calling shots. That's the amazing part. It was like Babe Ruth. It was like, you know, pointing to the bleachers and going bang, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a great feeling. I am not the best pinball player in the world, although I enjoy it immensely. But the feeling when you like catch a ball on the flipper, have someone next to you and you say, okay, I want to shoot this shot to get these big points, and you actually do it, there's nothing better.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is John Chad, writer, illustrator, and we're talking about his book, Pinball, a graphic history of the silver ball. You make the case for considering pinball sort of a hybrid media and art form.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the only device or kind of physical entity to embody that. You know, if you look at any, you know, there's shoes, there's, you know, action figures, maquettes and stuff. But it does encompass all of these, pinball does, all these different kind of disciplines. You know, graphic design is required. Illustration is required to make a pinball machine that works. And again, that's a pinball machine that communicates its rules and narrative clearly. Light shows, you know, things that are going to help guide the player's eye and help set the mood with lights. Sound design. Pinball machines now have screens on them, LCD screens, but they used to be dot matrix screens that have animation on them. So you're bringing in animators, and it all becomes, in the best case scenario, this kind of seamless experience that transports you to, quote unquote, the world under glass. You know,
it's amazing. You trace the evolution of pinball pretty far back. Especially, we'll say safely, to the 17th century, to a thing called Bagatelle. What's the name come from?
The name comes from a castle. The castle was built in France, and it was kind of the gambling, gaming getaway built by King Louis the 16th for his brother, Charles Philip.
It's funny, because that's entered our language, like a mere bagatelle. It's like a mere trifle.
Yeah. Well, I think in that sense, it's being used to say, you know, something that's a leisure. It's not required.
Right. It's not serious.
The same way, like, you don't need to put a pinball machine in your home, no matter what anybody says.
But it's a good thing if you do.
Oh, my gosh. Wonderful thing.
But what were these early bagatelles like? They didn't obviously have flippers or any of the bells and whistles.
So, like, the bagatelles that we're talking about from the 17th century castle bagatelle, think of like a pool table with one set of legs that's longer than the other, so it's inclined. And originally, you would take a pool cue in one of the corners, the lower right corner typically, which is where pinball balls are still launched from today, and you would launch the ball up to the top of this elevated pool table, or inclined pool table, and you would try to knock over pins, like bowling pins, tiny little bowling pins. And that was quickly replaced with holes because it was so obnoxious for the royals of the French court. They couldn't be bothered to set up these pins again. So they replaced them with holes. So it had a lot in common with pool. where it kind of turned to what we can more recognize. When you say Bagatelle at a pinball convention or in a pinball crowd, they're going to think kind of a flipperless tabletop game.
Right.
And that was really a function of who was interested in the game. When it transitioned from the royals and, you know, the nobility of the courts playing this game to the common person playing the game, it became a lot smaller and it became more mobile. And that's where we see the kind of the birth of the tabletop game kind of in the 17th and 18th century. And it would be the same sort of thing, though. Instead of a pool cue, you would have a kind of a plunger on a spring that would shoot the ball up, and you would have it fall into holes, just like in the larger version from Castle Bagatelle.
Now, by 1932, you had a game, I think it was Ballyhoo.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's lots of movement going on in Ballyhoo.
Ballyhoo is, you know, there's, I don't know what about Ballyhoo was so capturing of the public's imagination, but it was the top-selling game, and it really kind of kicked off what we talked about earlier being this golden age where people were just falling over themselves to play pinball and make pinball machines.
Well, it was the Depression, so there wasn't a lot of else to do, probably. but there was a lot of people moving the machine.
You mean like physically shaking?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, people realized pretty quickly that, you know, it's a small box. If you've ever seen one of these Bagatelle games, these like kind of pre-flipper pinball games, you're going to see that it's maybe 18 inches by 3 feet. They're not that big. They're made of wood. And
are they still sitting on a table, or they have legs?
Legs come in the later 1930s, but they come pretty quickly when all these shop owners, you know, drugstores, basically any place that sold goods to people would put in pinball machines. They were just everywhere. They eventually put on legs on them so that they wouldn't take up precious counter space. But at first they were just on counters, and you could imagine someone just kind of very quickly and easily lifting the end near them so that the ball rolls in an advantageous way.
Well, it's like those handheld games where you're trying to get the ball into certain pockets, and you're sort of you're sort of doing a big version of that.
Yeah, exactly. But even when players weren't kind of cheating in that overt way, people were, you know, beginning to shake the machine and kind of guide the ball into those big point holes, you know, for a high score.
So when did tilt come in?
Tilt came in that had to come with
electricity.
There were some pre-electricity tilt methods. Like there was a version where I read about where you would have like a ball on a pedestal. And in the book I reference it, it's called a stool pigeon. Mm. It's a type of tilt device. But even before that, you would have just a ball on a pedestal that if you shook it too hard, it would fall off. And the operator or a location owner could kind of see from afar like, hey, you're shaking the machine too much. But 1934 is kind of like the start of this idea of the tilt era, this idea that if you shake the machine too much, if you tilt it, it ends the game. And that term comes from Harry Williams, one of the great pinball designers.
He brought electricity to the game. I mean, he really helped electrify the game.
And electricity, I think, was one of the big reasons for pinball's kind of just like huge astronomic growth. Because as you said, it was the Great Depression. And people were able to interact with electricity in a way that I think was not available to many people on a like a common person level. You know, I've done some like adjustments for inflation. And playing a pinball game back there, which was like the height of invention, was, you know, like between a penny to 5 cents. And accounting for inflation today, that would be like anywhere between like 20 and 90 cents.
Wow.
And I challenge you to go somewhere that has gaming that's like at the height of invention and try to play it for 20 to 90 cents.
Yeah. Now, what about the back box? Because one of the great things about pinball is that whole artistry of the back part that's standing up. So now the pinball machine's got legs, and the back box, that whole back design, really evolves into this complex thing.
Yeah, the first game to kind of have like some semblance of a back box that was just being used to communicate score was in 1935. It was Crisscross, and it had a row at the bottom of this back box. And this was like, if you can imagine, well, when I say pinball, people usually now envision a kind of rectangular box that has another rectangular box popping up. But back then, the box in the back, which is called the back box, is a very straightforward name. It was probably like only like 6 inches tall, and it would have a row of, you know, lights that would light up to tell you what your score was. Between 1935 and 1938, people realized that like this back box area could be used, as you said, to kind of communicate some of the theming of the game. They could be used almost like a marquee to draw people in, but also to communicate the score that the players got. So you started to see these bigger and bigger and bigger back boxes until 1938, when the back box was as big as essentially we see today.
How was scoring kept before this, before electronic scoring? Did people just keep it in their head?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You just look down and you're like, well, that hole's worth 5,000 points. That hole's worth 300 points. I guess I got 5,300 points.
Jesus. Now, my favorite part of any pinball game are the flippers. Mm-hmm. When were the flippers introduced?
Flippers were, I think that's like 1938. Let me double. I feel bad for not knowing
yeah,
that.
Yeah. That changed the game. That changed the game.
That was absolutely a game changer. Harry Mabbs was working on a pitch and bat game, which is a different type of coin-operated game that does have a flipper. And in this game, it's like a baseball game. And a single ball is ejected onto the play field from the center where the pitcher's mound would be. And it rolls down, and you have one chance to flip the flipper. You flip it once, and it locks. You can no longer flip the flipper. And your goal is to, you know, hit targets that indicate what your runs are, or how many bases you get. And so he's working on one of these pitch and bat games, and he's working on this flipper mechanism, trying to put it together. And he accidentally short circuits it, and he taps the wires together in rapid succession. And the thing starts flipping like crazy.
Wow.
And he realizes, wait a minute. If I just like can find out a way that I can connect and disconnect this circuit, I can replicate this, and the person can just flip this bat as much as they want. And he immediately got to work to try to integrate it into a pinball machine.
And what I love about this book is you have all the basic flipper moves diagrammed and explained. So the cradle, the hold pass, if people don't know, there's all sorts of things you can do with the flippers.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I think is a real wow factor when people, and it's one of the things that helps people kind of shed the initial preposition that like pinball is just there's no hope. It is chance. It's like, well, no, I can catch the ball. I can move the ball to whichever flipper I want. I can use special moves to kind of react to how the ball is moving. I'm in control, not the ball.
Now, talk about the evolution of sound, because that's another big part of the pinball experience, is getting all those sounds. And eventually, you'll get machines that talk back to you.
Yeah. Sound, that came really early on. I think 1935 or 34 is when Harry Williams, again, the pinball innovator, he came up with the first sound in pinball, which was literally a solenoid, which is a kind of like electricity-powered piston. Would hit a bell on the inside of a machine. That was quickly increased to like 3 to 4 chimes. And that's kind of how sound was for the majority of pinball's existence from the 1930s to the 1970s, around 1975 to be specific. Pinball machines would use, you know, any number of chimes and circuits to try to, you know, replicate sounds. And you'd get these kind of crude songs and these, you know, crude series of sound effects.
But then you got the game Gorgar, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
The machine reacts audibly to your play.
In 1976, the Spirit of 76 was the first pinball machine to incorporate solid-state electronics. And that was the advent of computerized sound and sound generation. And from that point on, you could have any number of sounds. Speech was a little harder to replicate because it's not like a MIDI sound. And yeah, Gorgar was the first game. And Gorgar had 7 words. And they would just kind of, you know, stick these words together in different combinations in order to get, you know, you beat Gorgar, Gorgar beat you.
Gorgar yeah, beat
Gorgar
you.
Gorgar speaks. Beat, you know, the fact that Gorgar speaks was so so important that speaks was actually one of Gorgar's words.
Now, we have just minutes left, but late 70s, Pong happens. Mm-hmm. And now here comes video games. The whole video game revolution must have done a number on pinball.
It did. My personal belief is that without pinball, video games would have had a much harder time catching hold. And the pure reason for that is that by the time the 1970s roll around and Pong's coming out, pinball has already kind of established a brick-and-mortar infrastructure for gaming.
Right.
So, like, all of these pinball parlors, all these places that are carrying pinball machines, all these people who know how to work on solid-state machines because of pinball, they now can transition and implement video games like that. And, yeah, you know, at first, video games really gave pinball a run for their money. They were easier to maintain. They have far less moving parts. They're quicker to play. You know, people can lose a game of Pac-Man quicker than they can lose a game of Gorgar. And that means money for operators and location owners.
That's right.
You can also, you know, on some games, play multiple people at the same time, whereas pinball, you're playing, you know, in a line. Player one plays, player two, player three, player four. A four-player game is going to take a long time versus arcade games. You can have all four at the same time playing.
We're going to have to, John, we're going to have to stop here. We're out of time. People are going to need to buy the book to find the end of the story. And you'll find out why the game Addams Family is so good, too. My guest tonight has been John Chad, writer, illustrator. And we've been talking about his beautiful, colorful book, Pinball, A Graphic History of the Silver Ball. John, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, always a pleasure to talk gaming and pinball.
I got that feeling. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.